Good day, and welcome to the An Evening with Greg Valliere, a View from Washington conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Cheryl Holland. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to An Evening with Greg Valliere, a View from Washington. Hosted by the Delta Group, a consortium of flagship financial advisory firms across the country. I'm Cheryl Holland, President of Abacus Planning Group, joined by our colleagues and their clients, Paul Fain of Asset Planning Corp, Tim Casterly of Burke & Casterly, Kira Morris of Morris Financial Concepts, and Elisa Bowie and Dave Yeske of Yeske Bowie. Greg Valliere is the Chief Political Strategist with the Potomac Research Group. I love their tagline, Deciphering Washington for Wall Street. And I think many of us have felt in the past few years that perhaps someone needs to decipher Wall Street for Washington. Greg has a storied 30-year career covering Washington for investors, and I underscore that word because that's the reason we're together this evening. His expertise, which he lives here with us, centers on how Congress and the White House shape fiscal policy. For me, that means my taxes and the budget for the government, and monitors the Federal Reserve interest rate policies. I always appreciate Greg's guidance in helping us make better decisions with our clients. Greg will share his thoughts and insights for 25 minutes or so. We will then open the conversation to the audience. The operator, Ken, will provide instructions on how to ask questions at that juncture. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Cheryl. What a pleasure to be with you and everyone listening in this evening. Delighted to be with you. And, yes, at the end, I would love to get some questions and feedback from all of you. I think that makes it a much more enjoyable event. Well, I would just add to what Cheryl said at the beginning that while I've covered Washington for a long time, I think I'm a cynic more than anything else. I do not come to you this evening as an ideologue. I'm not here to tell you the right wing is correct or the left wing is correct. I just don't think that's very productive for you as investors. I'm much more inclined to view everything with a jaundiced eye after being here for so many years and seeing how dysfunctional, unfortunately, this town can be. I'm going to talk about several big issues tonight, starting with perhaps the biggest one of all, and that's the economy. Where are we right now? Where do things stand? I'm very fortunate in my day job at Potomac Research Group. I get to work with a distinguished former Fed official, Don Cohn. Don was the vice chairman of the Fed for several years, still very well plugged in. And he tells me that within the Fed, they're still very concerned about an economy that seemingly has slowed this summer. Lots of headwinds, whether it's Europe, the fiscal cliff, higher gasoline and food prices, and they fear at the Fed that second half economic growth may not be a heck of a lot better than 2%. So they still keep options on the table. They didn't do anything at the last meeting, but they meet again on September 12th. And I think at that FOMC meeting, there'll be a very serious discussion about additional measures. They'll have some more data. They'll get on Friday, the 7th of September, the unemployment number for August, which will be very important. Was the last number kind of a fluke? It was a little stronger than people thought. Or will it continue to show a very anemic recovery? We'll also get some very important clues at the end of this month from the chairman, Ben Bernanke, who will speak at Jackson Hole. But I think you've got to say the Fed will consider on September 12th a wide range of measures that at some point may be adopted, if not then, maybe after the election. I think they'd like to keep their heads down and not do anything right at election time. But the options would include adding more to the balance sheet, mostly, I think, through mortgage-backed securities. It would include perhaps lowering the funds rate to officially zero. Right now it's a range of 0 to 25. It would include paying zero on bank reserves that are held at the Fed. Right now they pay 25 basis points, and I think they would consider going to zero to encourage banks to lend more. There's a program in the UK whereby banks are encouraged to lend more that the Fed, I think, will look at as well. With all of these options, though, I don't see anything dramatic. And frankly, I don't think there's a lot here that could jumpstart this economy. It might be good for the stock market, I mean, the adage we've all been taught is that you don't fight the Fed, and the stock market perhaps would be disappointed if the Fed did nothing. So at the margin, it might be a plus for the stock market, but I really can't see any ammunition left on the part of the Fed because rates are so incredibly low already. The one option that sends shivers down my spine is when I hear that, you know, would the Fed reflate? Would they consider a higher inflation target? And there are a couple of doves at the Fed, in particular Charles Evans in Chicago, who would argue for raising the Fed's inflation target, which is 2% now, maybe temporarily going to 4%. I think that's a slippery slope that Ben Bernanke would prefer not to get on, because I can hear the inevitable criticism on CNBC the next day that the Fed is reflating, and I don't think they want to go there. So I don't see that as one of the options that would be imminent in their thinking. They're going to stay very accommodative for a very long time. I joke that the Fed will keep the funds rate at zero for the rest of my life, and I hope to live another 25 or 30 years. So it's going to be a long period of time with them being accommodative. I understand the arguments that some of you may have that this is not fair to savers. There are a lot of companies like Charles Schwab Company. A lot of companies don't like having interest rates this low. When I talk to my mother, who's 88 up in New England, she berates me because rates are too low. She was counting on a much higher yield in her retirement, and she and perhaps many of you are not getting that higher yield. But I do think the Fed will stay accommodative. They may get some political heat if Mitt Romney is elected, and we can talk about that perhaps during Q&A. I think when you look at this frustrating economy, seemingly frozen in place, you have to conclude that one of the major reasons is the fiscal cliff. This enormous amount of uncertainty that is going to face the economy as we get into the fourth quarter. I would argue the fiscal cliff already is having a negative impact on the economy. I think it is precluding companies from spending. Companies are sitting on phenomenal balance sheets, lots of cash, but I don't think they want to hire. I don't think they want to buy new equipment because they don't know what taxes are going to look like at the beginning of next year. And I think individuals as well are cautious when they hear all these stories about the uncertainty surrounding this fiscal cliff. So let me move to this next big theme and spend a few minutes on the fiscal cliff and the possible implications. I think they're very important implications for all of you as investors. First of all, I would like to be able to tell you that Congress will get its act together and do something before the election on the fiscal cliff, but they won't. They come back after Labor Day, and believe it or not, after a five-week vacation that they're on right now, they'll have 13 legislative days between their return and going out for the election. There's not enough time. They can't even decide on what to do with the post office or farm aid during a drought. So there certainly is not enough time for them to deal with the fiscal cliff before the election. After the election, they're back for a couple of days, and then there's the Thanksgiving Day break, and they really don't start negotiating in earnest until the 1st of December on all of these enormous issues that constitute the fiscal cliff. So let's take them individually, the big issues in the fiscal cliff. First of all, there's what we call the tax extenders. Every year, it used to be routine. They would extend the AMT fix, keeping millions of people out of the alternative minimum tax. They would add to that, you know, bonus depreciation, R&D tax credit. They could get that done in December. I don't rule that out. I think that is doable. I think also they'll get the so-called doc fix done, payments to doctors that every year have to be redone as part of Medicare. I'm not sure they'll figure out a way to pay for it, but they'll do that. But then we're left with three enormous issues that I would argue cannot possibly be done by the end of the year because of the very short number of days that are left. The three issues are as follows. First of all, the debt ceiling. People forget this fiasco we had a year ago today, wondering whether we'd raise the debt ceiling, fear of a credit rating downgrade, and of course we did get one from S&P, fear of a government default. We finally got a debt ceiling extension in early August, but it only is going to go until December of this year. So we have to go through that nonsense all over again in December to raise the debt ceiling. And I think the Tea Party will do pretty well in this election, and I think they're going to extract a price for extending the debt ceiling. One theory going around town that I think has some merit is that Bill Clinton's advice may be followed by Barack Obama. Bill Clinton all last summer said, just raise it. Just say, I hereby raise the debt ceiling. As I'm sure you know, President Obama has not been shy about using executive authority, and he may use it on this. I don't rule that out. If he doesn't, there's a messy fight on that. The other two big issues are really at the heart of what I would call the fiscal cliff. One of them is so-called sequestration. And in English, what that means is, since the deficit committee failed last November to come up with any kind of a deal, there's mandated cuts starting on January 2nd. $53 billion on defense, $53 billion on domestic discretionary spending. I've talked to enough people on the Hill to believe that the defense cuts will never take effect. If defense stocks are weak because of a threat of sequester, I think defense will dodge the bullet. Nobody, certainly no Republican, and most Democrats do not want additional cuts to defense. Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, doesn't want them either. The issue, of course, is how do you pay for this? If you exempt those $53 billion, the Democrats say, let's raise taxes. The Republicans say, let's cut social spending. That's the same argument we've heard year and year and year over and over again. And I personally think the sequester may be avoided in a deal, and we won't pay for it. You just won't get that hit. But if we do a sequester, the hit to the defense industry and a lot of domestic companies, especially companies that deal with NIH, that hit would be pretty significant. Then we come to the final element of the fiscal cliff, and the biggest one of all, and that, of course, involves the Bush tax cuts, which would expire on December 31st at midnight unless they're extended. If they are not extended, the top rate goes from 35 now back to the old top rate of 39.6. The capital gains rate goes from 15 now to 20. To be accurate, it would be 23.8 because you have to add 3.8 that came with the Obama health care bill. And ominously, the dividend tax would go from 15% to ordinary income, 39.6 plus 3.8. Lots of other things that I won't depress you all with. You know, the estate tax exemption goes from $5 million back to $1 million. A lot of very dire things would happen if it's not extended. The Bush tax cuts aren't extended on December 31st. So what's going to happen? I think, obviously, it depends on who wins the election, which I'll talk about in a second. I think that if Mitt Romney wins, he's made it quite clear he would prefer Congress to not do anything in December and to wait until after his inauguration, which would be January 20th. I think by early February, the Bush tax cuts would be reinstated. The sequester would be dealt with. I think that the most benign outcome would be a Romney victory, although I'm on the 50-yard line. I'm not advocating anybody tonight, but I think that would be the most benign outcome. If Obama wins, I think he'd want to go for some big, grand compromise, like, you know, Bowles-Simpson. The problem is that the Simpson-Bowles plan would never make it through the House because it contains a big chunk of tax increases. That's what Bill Clinton and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi want. They feel taxes should go up on the so-called wealthy. And I think if Obama tries that after the election, he would hit a brick wall in the House, which will stay very conservative. So I think under that scenario, on Friday, December 31st, members of Congress would say, gotta go, time for the holidays. We'll just kick the can down the road. We'll extend everything until the end of the first quarter. And we have to go through this BS all over again at the end of the winter. So under either scenario, I think we don't get resolution until sometime during the winter, maybe by February 1 with Romney, maybe by the end of the winter with Obama. Therefore, I hate to say it to all of you, the uncertainty will persist. The irony here is that I think the final deal will be pretty benign. We're not going to take dividend taxes to ordinary income. We're not going to take the estate tax exemption down from 5 to 1 million. It won't be that dire. The problem is I can't say that to anyone with absolute certainty. I can't tell any investor that, oh, yeah, you can wait. The capital gains rate will stay low in 2013. That's not certain. And it certainly won't be even remotely obvious until we get through the election to see who wins. So it, to me, is going to be a continued source of anxiety for investors. You talk to people in this town who, to my shock and dismay, are not focused in on all of the investment implications of not doing anything. They only are concerned with coming up with their best soundbite. They're more concerned with using arguments against the other party than dealing with the fiscal cliff. Now, some people say, well, the election will define everything. That'll be the defining issue. The public will give us a clear sign of where they want to go. Well, moving to the next big theme, the election, I would argue that we may get more dysfunction. We may be even more gridlocked after this upcoming election because I think it's going to be that close of an election. So let me talk a bit about how I see the election shaping up after a very interesting 72 hours with the vice presidential pick. I thought in the spring, in May and June, that Mitt Romney was the front runner. I thought he really adroitly consolidated power within the Republican Party. He looked like a president, acted like a president, did a very good job, I thought. And then we came to a mysterious period during the summer that no one who follows politics can quite figure out. During this period, in late June and all of July, the Obama campaign defined Romney with just a barrage of negative ads. The Romney campaign did not hit back quickly. They had PAC money. They did not fight back quickly to try to redefine Romney. So in all of these swing states, like Ohio, Romney was portrayed as Gordon Gekko, someone who cheats on his taxes, who fires people, and he didn't hit back hard enough. So in all of those states, you saw Romney's negatives go way up, and Romney started to trail. So then we come to late last week, and the polls were showing a widening lead for Obama. The Fox poll last Thursday showed a 9-point lead, much to my surprise. So I think Romney decided he had to go bold, but he could not go with Pawlenty or Portman, both of whom I thought would be perfectly acceptable running mates. He wanted to go with somebody who was really could shake things up. Not as flamboyant as Sarah Palin, but nevertheless, he wanted to throw the ball long and find somebody who really stood for something, like Paul Ryan. It's a risky play, and again, I don't have a dog in this hunt, but I would just tell you, my initial reaction on Saturday morning was, there goes Florida. It's going to make it more difficult for Romney to win Florida because Medicare is such a huge issue. Lots of new ads today. The Romney campaign is hitting right at Obama, saying Obama wanted to cut money on Medicare. We'll see how this plays out. I have done this long enough to know that if you touch the third rail, entitlements, you can get electrocuted. So it's a risky move because the Ryan plan is very bold in terms of tax cutting, in terms of spending reductions, including Medicare and Social Security. But a bold move like that has energized the party. I think the ticket has more pizzazz to it, but I don't think it helps with Florida, which gets me to two reasons why I think you have to say Obama is the slight favorite. Number one, it's a little easier for him to get to 270. That's what you need to win, of course. When you look at the states that Obama is likely or pretty likely to win, most experts put it at 230 or 240. So he's close. If he were to add Florida, if Romney lost Florida, I think it's very difficult to see Romney winning the presidency. Romney has little margin of error. He has to win Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, and one of the states in the north, probably Ohio, for him to get to his 270. It's not impossible. It's doable, but there's little margin for error, whereas Obama has a little more cushion. The other reason why I think Obama is the slight favorite is the fastest growing demographic group in America, and that, of course, is Hispanics. 4 years ago, Obama won 67% of the Hispanic vote. I talk to people in his campaign who think he can get over 70% because the Republican rhetoric was so strident during the debates against illegal immigration. If Obama can get 71 or 72%, and if you believe like I do, it's going to be a very close race, maybe not decided until 5 a.m. in Colorado and Nevada. Well, Colorado, which has 9 votes, Nevada, which has 6, are heavily Hispanic, and I think that could make the difference. So I still right now make Obama the slight favorite. I would be the first to concede that weaker economic data will help Romney. I think Romney will do better than expected in the debates. Somewhat like George W., the expectations were low, and Bush did pretty well. And I think the same thing could happen to Romney. But for now, at least, I think a narrow Obama victory is the most likely scenario. So why do I say it would lead to even more gridlock? Because I think Congress could become even more conservative after this election. If you look at both houses, I think the House unquestionably will stay Republican. It would take a 25 net seat gain for the Democrats to take the House. That's very, very unlikely. They might get 6 or 8, but I don't think they're going to get 25. The more interesting story is in the Senate, where there's no question in my mind the Republicans will gain seats. The magic number is 4 for the Republicans to take the Senate. That's doable. I think maybe 2 or 3 is virtually certain. The mix is unusual. Of the 33 seats up, only 10 are held by Republicans. And I only see one that could fall. That's in Maine. I think Scott Brown is going to hang on in Massachusetts against Elizabeth Warren. When you look at the 23 seats that the Democrats have, at least half of them look shaky, and maybe 7 or 8 look very vulnerable. So I think the Republicans will gain strength in the Senate, and it's an interesting mix of new senators. Several will be Tea Party members. Ted Cruz in Texas, the woman who won the primary in Nebraska, the guy who beat Dick Lugar in Indiana, all 3 Republicans favored to win, all 3 with Tea Party support. So for Mitch McConnell, it's a blessing and a curse. He gets more Republicans, but he gets Republicans who are far to the right of him. So I would see, with a lot of the adults leaving, Joe Lieberman's leaving, Olympia Snowe is leaving, Dick Lugar's leaving, Ben Nelson's leaving, I would see more gridlock as we move into 2013. So let me finish with one additional theme, and that is, can we, regardless of who wins, can we move to really dramatic deficit reduction? And my answer is probably not, for one major reason, and that is, there is no really angry market catalyst demanding it. The Treasury 10-year bond yield is 1.5%. There's an insatiable demand worldwide for U.S. debt. At some point, the bond market might say, hey, you know, enough is enough, guys. You got to get your act together on the deficit. But with interest rates at 1.5%, I think we're missing a catalyst to get the people in Washington agitated on doing something. There's huge differences on what to do, of course. And as I point out, the Simpson-Bowles proposal was put before the floor of the House in May, and it got 38 votes. People don't like the idea of radical spending cuts, radical entitlement reform, or big new tax increases. So if Obama wins, I think it's very unlikely that we would have any breakthrough on the deficit. If Romney wins, a little more likely. I think he probably would bring a Republican Senate with him, and they probably would be able to move on some additional deficit reduction. But I don't see a big blockbuster along the lines of Simpson-Bowles. Final thing, then I'll stop. We would be remiss if we didn't talk for a couple of minutes about geopolitics, and I would just point out 2 things that you have to be concerned about. Number one is, you know, I don't think that we are even remotely out of the woods in Western Europe. You know, Mario Draghi says he will do whatever it takes to keep the euro alive, but when he said that, everyone scratched their heads because I'm not sure he can get the Germans to go along with what he would like, which would be guaranteeing bond offerings from countries like Spain or Greece. So I think many countries in Western Europe are now headed into a deep, deep recession. It's hurting our exports. It's hurting GM. And I think that we still have a long way to go before we can see Europe clawing out of this mess. The final problem, the biggest one of all, the one that really would keep me awake at night, obviously, is Israel-Iran. The signals have gotten much more negative over the last 2 or 3 months. I and many had hoped that maybe the Iranians could be persuaded to negotiate, and they have been utterly, totally resistant to any kind of serious negotiations or transparency with their nuclear program. I think Benjamin Netanyahu would not want to initiate a war during the U.S. presidential campaign, because traditionally a geopolitical crisis helps an incumbent, and I think deep down in Netanyahu would prefer Romney to win. So I think if there's a window to be worried about, it's between our election day, November 6th, and the inauguration, January 20. I think that might be a period where tensions could rise. I just do not think that the Israelis will continue to tolerate the presence of a likely bomb being made in Iran, being made by a country that's so virulently anti-Semitic, willing to challenge the Israelis. So that to me is the big concern of all. There's a lot to worry about, and I hate to say this, but I'm usually an optimist by nature. It may not sound that way tonight. I do think once we get the fiscal cliff out of the way, just to end on an upbeat note, there's a lot of good stuff out there. Corporate balance sheets look great. State and local governments, with the exception of California and Illinois, look much, much stronger. The housing slump, I think, has bottomed. A lot of things to be upbeat about, but we have to get from here until the end of the fiscal cliff, and unfortunately, that's going to take several more months. So let me stop there. I probably went over my limit, but let me stop there and turn it over to Ken and see if we have some questions.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your phone. A voice prompt will indicate when your line is open, and we do ask that you state your name before posing your question. Once again, it is star 1 on your phone if you have a question. And we'll take our first question.
Hi, Greg. This is Stephen Scott. Thank you for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
I just have one question for you.
Sure.
What are the chances that the Obama health care reform law will be overturned?
Well, I think if Romney wins, there's a decent chance. I think there are parts that even Republicans would favor retaining, like pre-existing conditions or, you know, coverage of your kids until the age of 25. Obviously, the mandate is the great sticking point. But I think if Romney wins, a decent chance that it could be overturned. A real debate, not to get too arcane, but a real debate in the Senate as to whether you would need 60 votes or 50. They probably would use this process called budget reconciliation, which means they could kill it with 50. That's very doable, because even if the Republicans are one seat short of a majority, when you look at who is up for re-election in 2014 in the Senate, there's like 7 or 8 Democrats who look really shaky, like Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. So I think they might be able to get the votes in the Senate to overturn Obamacare. Obviously, if Obama wins, that's not going to happen.
Thank you.
Sure.
And we'll take our next question.
I think my line is open. I'm concerned.
Hi.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on. Yep.
Oh, yes. I'm concerned about the unemployment. It's hit very close to me. I have a son who had been employed for 10 years running, lost his position, and has been out of work for 7 or 8 months now. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that picture, in your estimation, regarding your comments about the fiscal cliff and banks lending and that type of thing, do you think that could change over the next several months, the unemployment picture?
Well, that's a good question. I think over the next several months, no. I think unemployment is going to stay, unfortunately, around 8%. Some would argue it's higher. Some would argue that people who do have work don't have the job they'd like to have. I don't see any change in that until we get the fiscal cliff resolved, and as I said earlier, at the earliest it would be right after Romney's inauguration on January 20, or it might take till the end of the winter. So under either scenario, I don't see a quick turnaround. Where I could get very optimistic is once we get a deal, I think there's a decent chance that businesses will open up their wallets and start to hire. I think I could be very encouraged by the economic and employment outlook as we go into the second and third quarters of next year. But I think for the rest of this year, for the second half of 2012, I think we're going to stay stuck right about where we are, around 8%, maybe slightly higher than 8%, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
And we'll take our next question.
Yes, this is. I have one question concerning the reelection of our president. Sometimes we get a change in thought processes as the politics is over, and we've got four more years, and there's nobody else going to run again. Give me your feelings about that.
That what would happen in four more years?
Yeah, I mean, you now have a president that doesn't have to run for reelection.
Right.
And there's a lot of things that have happened in second terms that are very beneficial to people.
Yep. Good point. Very good point. Well, there's been a lot of speculation about what his agenda might be in a second term. I've been told that in private, he really does want to address Social Security and put it on a sound footing. I mean, everybody who's looked at this knows what the answer is. It's not rocket science. It's basically raising the retirement age. I mean, I'm certainly willing to work until I'm 70 or 71. I think if people worked in construction jobs or nurses who are on their feet all the time, there might have to be a different standard for retirement. But I think there's a solution to Social Security, and I think he would move on that. You know, I hear from a lot of people who think he has a secret agenda that would move the country much further to the left in a second term. I just don't see that getting through Congress. I think Congress would thwart him at every step of the way. Congress will be very conservative. Boehner's there. Cantor, who's just itching to become the next Speaker of the House, and he probably will be in a couple of years. Now, I think they would thwart Obama. And it's worth noting, or worth repeating what I said a minute or two ago, and that is in 2014, if you look at who's up in the Senate, it's very, very, very easy to conclude that the Republicans will gain even more seats. So I see him being checked. You know, Bill Clinton, in his second term, had a Republican House and Senate, and he didn't get much done. I think he got welfare reform. He got some conservative things done. But I can't see any activist agenda being successful with Obama in a second term. I think he'd be looking at gridlock unless he really wanted to seriously negotiate with Congress.
Well, I think that's the point I'm trying to make. I really do believe that he'll probably try to cut better deals quickly.
That yes, you would think. I mean, he doesn't want to go down as someone who's been totally thwarted at every step of the way in a second term. So he's going to have to be more pragmatic. Had he been more pragmatic on the health reform bill, instead of giving it to Nancy Pelosi and Charlie Rangel, I think he would have gotten a better bill. But I think he was inexperienced. It was a rookie mistake. I think in the second term, he's going to know he's got to make some compromises. You know, one thing that might help, there's a lot of speculation as to who replaces Geithner. I keep hearing Erskine Bowles, who's a really first-rate guy, very moderate Democrat, cares about deficit reduction. If Obama went in that direction and got an Erskine Bowles, you could get some decent stuff done.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll take our next question.
Okay, following up on the unemployment scenario we mentioned
a
while ago, isn't it true that no incumbent has ever won a re-election with unemployment of greater than 8%?
Yep.
And it's currently 8.3 and maybe even go up more?
Yep.
So I understand your arguments about giving Obama a slight edge, and I mean, those are very logical arguments. But how about the big one? You know, we keep hearing it's the economy, stupid, you know.
Yep.
So if it's 8.3, 8.4, 8.5, doesn't that damper your projection about Obama somewhat?
That's a very astute point. My good friend Charlie Cook, who's one of the very best in the business, I'm sure a lot of you know or have heard of Charlie, you know, he just keeps saying it's the economy, it's the economy. Reagan won in 1984. With the unemployment rate in the high sevens, but it was coming down dramatically. You know, there was a pretty nasty recession in 81, 82, but the economy clearly was recovering in the fall of 84, and he easily beat Mondale. This time will be the highest unemployment rate ever if Obama were to win, and that's a big, big impediment. And I've seen polls that show that a majority of Americans think Romney would do a better job on the economy. I've seen polls that show a majority of Americans think we're still in a recession even though the official, you know, arbiters declared we were out of it 3 years ago. It still feels like a recession for so many people, including the gentleman who asked about unemployment and people who worry about foreclosures. So you're absolutely right. The economy is the big albatross. Let me put it this way. Here's my take as of mid-August. As of mid-August, I think the Republicans have made a compelling case for firing Obama. They have not made a compelling case for hiring Romney and Ryan. So they've got half of the battle done, but that other half of the battle still remains. And that's where Obama has his opening. His opening is going to be to allege that things would get worse, or they'd just go back to the same mistakes we had with Bush. But half of that battle has been won, and it's been won because of the economy. You're absolutely right.
Just one quick follow-up question. It won't take as long.
Please.
Given you don't see a much optimistic, rosy outlook for the economy, at least for the next 6 months.
Yep.
And I know you're not a financial advisor, but it's, you know, it's all of us investors on the phone. I mean, just basing what you know, would you sort of generally say stay the course of what we're doing, or, you know, pull back to more secure, type of investments, less risky, more secure type of investments until the storm is over?
Yeah, I there's so many very bright people on this call from Abacus and elsewhere who I have a lot of faith in, who could be more helpful on that. My personal take is that this is not a great period to be risky. I would be a little cautious during this period. I am personally, but I defer to all my friends on the call. They're the real experts.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll take our next question.
Greg, this is Jeff Brooker in Columbia, South Carolina.
Hey, Jeff.
I was just wondering what you think is a practical outcome of the tax code implications of what you alluded to towards the end of your presentation being one of the three big issues facing our nation,
mm-hmm.
In particular, increasing tax rates, uncertainty about the estate tax laws,
mm-hmm.
If I'm reading the tea leaves right, there's a lot of let's just kick the can down the road one more year.
Yep.
And so doesn't that, though, kind of undermine fiscal responsibility on a national level,
mm-hmm.
when you don't have a relatively static tax code?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let me answer. It's a very good question. Let me answer it in two ways. The first would be near term. The second would be longer term. Near term, I think that an awful lot depends on who gets elected, and if we'll know on the morning of November 7th who won, obviously. I think that if Romney wins, there's not going to be as tax increases on anybody. The Bush tax cuts would prevail in the short run. If Obama wins, he's going to have a hard time getting a lot through the House, but if there's a big impasse, I could see a deal where he got some increase. I can't rule out capital gains going to 20 or 20.3.8. I can't rule out somebody may wind up paying the old top rate of 39.6. I think we're going to have a debate in this country over just what is rich. You know, the White House says $250,000 a year for family income is rich. Well, if you live in, you know, Midtown Manhattan or San Francisco and you've got three kids in college, that's not rich. Chuck Schumer has said it's $500,000, and Nancy Pelosi, to my shock, has said it's $1 million. So we're going to have to redefine what's rich, first of all. Getting back to my point, I think somebody, if Obama wins, will wind up paying 39.6, the old top rate. So that's in the short run. In the longer term, I think all investors have to keep their eyes open on talks of a fundamental tax reform. Now, I've been doing this a long time, and I hear people every few years say, well, we got to lower the top rate and just have a simplified tax code, and we can send our taxes in by postcard. And everybody now is saying, well, let's go from 35% down to 25, 26%. That's going to be a big push in the longer term if Romney wins, and by the Republicans who will control Congress. But my take is, should all of you listening start to worry about the muni bond deduction going? I don't think so. I think that's like sacred. There's no way in the world they're going to. So there's one big exemption that would stay. Do you worry about the mortgage deduction going? Well, not in its entirety. I can't see that happening. Should people worry about the child credit going? Well, you know, Santorum and the social conservatives want to raise the child credit. Should we worry about charitable contributions? Well, when you start looking at these things, you add up all of the things that everybody wants to keep, and before you know it, this whole thing sinks from its own weight. So I am not a believer in the long term that radical tax reform is imminent. I certainly wouldn't use that as a reason to be nervous about muni bonds. I think the gentleman who asked me a question a minute ago about being safe, you can't get much safer than in most every state in the country, I think, is very safe. And I don't think there's going to be a tax on muni bond interest income. So in the long term, yeah, there are a lot of big philosophical issues about bringing the rate lower and looking at all the exemptions that most of us like. In the short run, I really do think it depends on who wins. If we wake up on the day after election and Obama has won, I think that could be very troubling for the market because of the implications for dividend and capital gains rates, which could go up a little. They're not going to go up as high as maybe Obama would like because the House wouldn't let him. But the tax policies would not be as favorable, in my opinion, if Obama won as opposed to Romney. I'm sorry it's a long answer, but it's a complicated question.
Right, right. Thank you.
You bet.
As another reminder, it is *1 if you have a question. We'll take our next question. Whoever heard the voice prompt, your line's now open.
I can't hear. Someone may be trying to ask a question, but I can't hear him.
And hearing no response, we'll go to the next question.
This is George Carruth. I had a question.
Sure.
What will it take to get companies to invest the $1 trillion they have sitting on?
Good question. There's two answers that I hear, because I asked the exact same question, sir. The first is companies just don't know, can't make, concrete plans 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 months out because they don't know what tax and economic policies will be. Another answer I hear involves this concept of repatriation, whereby the U.S. Treasury allows companies that have stashed huge profits overseas to bring them home at a tax rate of 4 or 5%. It would add a little more to the U.S. Treasury. It would certainly add to companies and perhaps prompt them to hire and build new plant and equipment. But I don't see the current environment being very conducive for companies to open up their wallets. I think they're going to sit back and wait and see just how things unfold. That's why the outlook for the gentleman I talked to 15 minutes ago was so difficult on unemployment. I think unemployment is going to stay roughly where it is until corporate America can figure out what policies there are going forward. And that's going to take a few more months.
And at this time, we have no additional questions on the phone.
Should we turn it over to Cheryl?
Greg? Yes. Are there any closing comments that you would like before we log off? Certainly appreciate your insights and thoughts and great questions that we've had.
No, I agree. You guys gave me a good workout. I hope you enjoyed it. Maybe we can do this again some point later in the year or next year. I'm still an optimist at heart, and these problems, we'll get through these problems. And I think that we've been through 3, 4, 5 very, very difficult years, and I can start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think if we did this call in the spring of next year, I think the fundamentals would look one heck of a lot better than they look right now. So I'm gonna end on that thought.
And, Greg, I would just want to share with our audience that we recorded the call this evening, so if you would like to have a copy for yourself or you'd like to share with a friend, please reach out to your advisor, and we will make sure that you get a copy. Thank you very much, everyone.
So long. Good evening.
and gentlemen, once again, that does conclude today's call. We do appreciate everyone's participation.